Translation. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu remained in householder life for 24 years, and on the verge of his 25th year, he accepted the sannyas order. Purport. There are four orders of spiritual life, namely brahmacharya, grihastha, vanaprastha, and sannyas. And in each of these ashrams, there are four divisions. The divisions of the brahmachari ashram are, okay, all you brahmacharis, listen up, please. This is for you. Savitriya, Prajapatya, Brahma, and Brihat. Okay? And the divisions of the Grihastha ashram, all you Grihasthas, please listen up, are Varta, professionals, Sanchaya, accumulators, Shalina, those who do not ask anything from anyone, and Shilonchana, those who collect grains from the paddy field. Similarly, the divisions of the Vanaprastha ashram are, okay, all you Vanaprasthas, listen up, Vaikanasa, Valakilya, Audumbara, and Fenapa. Okay, what do those mean? We will find out. And the divisions of sannyas are, all the sannyasis, please listen carefully, those who want to take sannyas in the future, Kutichak, means someone who sits somewhere and somebody brings you maha. Bahudak means you sit outside the village and someone may or may not bring you the maha. Hamsa, no maha. Nishkriya, not a chance. There are two kinds of sannyasis who are called dhiras and narottamas, as stated in Srimad Bhagavatam 1.13.26-27. At the end of the month of January, in the year 1432 Shakabda, which is 1510 AD, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted the sannyas order from Keshava Bharati, who belonged to the Shankara Sampradaya. Oma Gyanitamirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Jena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Mano Bishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swa Padantikam. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu Ki Jai. So, no doubt yesterday you heard about some aspects of Lord Chaitanya taking sannyas and why he did that. It's not enough just to appear in this world as Krishna's pure devotee. It's not enough just to appear in this world as someone exhibiting Mahabhav. This is not enough to convince some people. Some people, they need you to be somebody powerful. It's called celebrity endorsement in the modern world. If David Beckham uses this type of shaving blade, then it must be good. Why? Because he's famous. If somebody famous or somebody very rich and powerful, if someone stands in front of you and he's on the Sunday Times rich list, you know, and he's number 10, and he says, I made my money by XYZ, then you'll have a go at doing that too, if you're also interested in the goals that he has. And who is there really who doesn't want any more money? You ask anybody sitting in this room, and I'm not going to, would you like more money than you have? Those who are faking it will say, me? No. I'm just very happy with what Krishna gives me. Okay. That's because it takes a lot of money to give you what Krishna gives you if you live in this temple. Those of you who do not live in this temple will understand how much money it takes. Those who live in this temple will not. Everybody needs money. And no matter how much you have, you need more. So if someone on the rich list says, this is how I made my money, there's a temptation. Yes, okay. He knows what he's talking about. If someone is beautiful and she comes in front of you and she says, like on the ads, I use oil of Yule, or I use this hair product because I'm worth it. See, ladies, everybody knows that one. I did a wedding one time outside Paris in a converted barn. And I got talking to one young man. I said, what do you do for a living? He said, I make commercials. I said, what sort of commercials do you make? He said, oh, TV commercials. I do hair product commercials. I said, which one do you do? He said, oh, you know the one where the woman goes, because I'm worth it. And I said, yeah, I think I know that one. And I said, so how does that work? Does she actually use that product? He said, no way. He said, nobody uses the products that they endorse. They only say that because they get paid. Popped another bubble. But I don't mind, you see, I don't use hair products. And I know a lot of other men who don't use hair products. I've grown up with them. Hair product is Gillette. Actually, we do have a celebrity endorsement. Prabhupada said, if it is not Gillette, it is simply bogus. Did you know that? I said it upstairs here. Ah, bogus, he said. Not Gillette. Anyway, so if there's a celebrity endorsement, we're more inclined. So who were the celebrities? Who were the most respected persons? Well, they were the sannyasis. And who were the sannyasis? Well, the sannyasis were the Shankarites, because Shankara had done a very good job of capitalizing on the sannyas order. Unfortunately, the Vaishnav Tridandi sannyas was very much depressed. It was depressed under Buddhism. And Buddhism was so skillful at forming a new type of sannyas where they didn't carry sticks, but they met together. How did they do that? Well, Buddhists actually followed the tradition of the... Did I say this last time? Probably I did say it last time. Sannyasis, they move around for 8 months of the year, and then for 4 months of the year during the rainy season, they sit in one place. And they often gather together in one place, and that is how, of course, Narada Muni in his last life got to have Bhagavat Prasad, because the rishis were all gathered in one place and his mother was looking after them. So it's a chance for people to serve the sannyasis. And the place where they live is known as a guha, or a cave. It's often known as a cave because that's what it is. It's a cave. So they live there. Why? Because it's the rainy season. You live somewhere. You don't live under a tree, as a sannyasi normally would. You live in a waterproof place. Have you ever lived under a tree? I have. I used to live under a tree when I was traveling. When I was 16, I was traveling and trying to, you know, discover the universe or something. But the universe discovered me, and it discovered me under a tree, and it rained on me. And I saw the light. But unfortunately, the light was the policeman's torch. And he said, you can't sleep here, son. So that was how enlightened I was when I was 16. So if you sleep under a tree, it may rain, it may not rain. So if you sleep in a cave, which I also have done, it's much better. Only my cave was a big water pipe, and that was dry. So that was rather nice. It was in Yorkshire, if you're interested. And it was under the road. So all night long, zhoom, zhoom, zhoom. I don't think the sannyasis had that to contend with in those days. But anyway, they used to live in caves. Keep dry, keep warm, keep away the wolves and the tigers. So the Buddhists then, they did two things. They captured urban centers, because Buddhism was very much interested in royal patronage, as you are. Because if the king says you're okay, again, celebrity endorsement. If the king says you're okay, then you're okay. And if the king says you're okay, but he says that the Vaishnavas are not okay, then there could be some persecution for the Vaishnavas. So unfortunately, the history of Vaishnavism is also the history of generational persecution. Persecution under the Buddhists, persecution under the Islamic invaders, and persecution under Shivite kings. So the history of Vaishnavism has not always been smooth. We have been persecuted generation after generation, and it's still going on. And now the persecutors are the, they used to be the communists. But we shall soon find another person who persecutes, because Vaishnavism seems to thrive when in difficult circumstances. So under Buddhism, Buddhism became very popular. Why did Buddhism become popular? Because basically Brahmins don't always do what they should, and sannyasis are not always in a position to do what they should. Now, when we think of a sannyasi, we think of a person who we see regularly. But if a sannyasi is doing his job according to Shastra, he's traveling. As Narada Muni says, he's traveling, and he leaves no trail, like a fish swimming through water or a bird flying through the air. Is he going to come back next year? You don't know. Is he going to be teaching something next year when he comes back? You don't even know if he is going to come back. Therefore, sannyasis don't initiate. They just travel. The grihasthas initiate because they're in one place. Initiation means being initiated into a course of study. You learn something. So the grihastha would teach, and the Brahmin grihastha would teach, and the sannyasi Brahmin would travel. He would give what is called upanyas. Upanyas means an inspirational talk wherever he was. And the grihastha would give the upadesh, which means the instructional talk. It's more focused on you. You and your problems. Whereas the sannyasi, when he speaks, he gives the collective you. He gives a talk to everybody. And you may or may not pick up on what he says and be inspired. You see? But it can be less personal. So the point here is that the Buddhists wanted to do two things. They wanted to capture the Hindu places of worship, the Charadhams, the foremost holy places in Hinduism. And so they went there and they formed collectives known as guhas or caves. Did they move on after the rainy season? No, they just stayed in place. So therefore, that was one way they did it. Then they got royal patronage. And the kings were very much into Buddhism. And they put up stupas so people would be able to read Buddhist teachings all over India. You see, and they set up temples. And they set up universities, actually. There was one Chinese traveler who's traveling way, way, way back, maybe in 200 AD or something like that. And he's looking around, and he's talking about Buddhist universities where there are so many students, in order to accommodate them, they have to have a 7-floor ashram. Now, that's pretty impressive. How many floors of ashram do we have here? I know we have a few floors. We have 3 floors, but only one is ashram. 7 floors of ashram, ashram space. And that's just one building. How many students? How many brahmacharis altogether? 20,000. 20,000 in one location. Now, brahmachari in those days did not mean a preacher on behalf of a missionary organization. Brahmachari meant a person who's undergoing studies. And in the morning he studies shastra, but in the afternoon he studies accountancy. Why? Because his brahmachari years are going to come to an end and he's going to have a job. And this is a system that's still running in India. But the Buddhists were very clever. They taught things that were very impressive. They taught trigonometry, calculus. They taught advanced mathematics, algebra. They taught building. So in the same way, after all those boys had graduated, and celibacy is seen as something which is an aid to study, seen as an aid to study. So it wasn't that brahmachari life and Krishna consciousness go hand in hand. They do, of course. But in this particular case, brahmachari life and the intense study of trigonometry go hand in hand. Why? Because if you're not celibate, you won't be able to remember what the teacher tells you. And that's why celibacy was so important, even in Cambridge. It wasn't even until 1976 that they let girls in some of the colleges at Cambridge. Why? Well, now you can see the result. You can see the result in Cambridge and Oxford, what the students get up to when there are girls in the same building as the boys. You see? So, university years were meant for intense study, and intense study commands you to be a celibate person because celibacy aids memory. If you don't remember You're not going to call it up on your computer because they didn't have computers. The most important computer was the one that's attached to your neck. That was what you did your thinking with. In my day, when I was a kid, they told me, oh, they've invented something called a computer. And did you know, it's almost as fast as the human brain. Now they say, oh, this person is so intelligent, he's almost like a computer. We're measuring ourselves up to the machines. Don't do it. The most sophisticated computer ever imaginable is the one that has two ears, two eyes, and a nose. And it has a lot of apps to go with it. But the more you extrapolate that outside your body, the less you can use the one on your shoulders. So the one on the shoulders has some pretty sophisticated software to go with it. Something called Super Soul software. And you have to listen very carefully. So here the Buddhists captured these places. Then when Shankaracharya came along, what did he do? He did exactly the same thing. He captured the king. He captured the Cambridge and Oxford of the day. Just like today. If you can go to a place, who has a Cambridge degree or an Oxford degree? Raise your hand very proudly. Very rare. Very rare. You didn't raise your hand proudly. I knew you were sitting there, but you're not proud. Okay, he has humility. Who has a degree from a polytechnic? Just see. Polytechnic. Of course, now all the polytechnics have become universities in a bid to have endorsement from the word university. Okay? So the point is, if you've got an Oxford degree or a Cambridge degree, of which I have neither, in fact, I don't even have A-levels, they will say, very good. Very good. Even if you spent your time in Cambridge with late-night drinking parties and chasing the women on the ashram floor below you, even if your habits were more like a rabbit than they were a professor, of course, a lot of the professors are like rabbits too, people, if you have a Cambridge degree or an Oxford degree, or certainly Harvard or Yale or Princeton, they will say, oh, very good, very good. When can you start work with us? And if you have another type of degree, it may be that you know even more than the person who went to Cambridge, because the one who went to Cambridge has just wasted his time. So you may be the same quality first degree, but if it has that ox on the end or cams on the end, you're in. You're part of an elite club. So if you were a Vaishnava sannyasi, that was regarded as not very advanced. If you were one of the Dashanami Shankarite sannyasis, that was considered, oh, that is very good. You've got the very special qualification there. And so that is why we find Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he could have gone to the Sri Vaishnavas to take sannyas. It's got nothing to do with his Sampradaya affiliation. But he took Shankara sannyas, because this is the most prestigious. Of course, it wasn't the most prestigious, because no sooner had he taken sannyas, and he went to Jagannath Puri, and Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya said, wow, I could reinitiate you, and I can arrange for you to have a higher sannyas. I see that you're one of the lower order Shankarite sannyasis. I can give you a higher order. You've come to the right person. So there was a lot of prestige involved in being a sannyasi. And therefore, if someone appeared in your... It wasn't like us, you see. Here, at Bhaktivedanta Manor, how often do we see a sannyasi? Once a day? Twice a day? Three times a day? How often do they come to this temple? All the time. Isn't it? Who's coming this week? I speak to the Brahmacharis. Who's coming this week? Well, we've got such and such Maharaj coming, and such Maharaj coming, and this Maharaj and that Maharaj coming. It was not like that in medieval India. The arrival of a sannyasi to your village was, wow, wonderful occasion. Wonderful occasion. When devotees went to Gujarat in India. Gujarat in India. Who do I think I'm speaking to? I'm used to speaking in other places. Yes, Gujarat is in India. When they went through Gujarat on the Padyatra in 1986 to celebrate the 500th anniversary of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's birth, when they arrived at different villages, when they had brahmacharis in saffron, shiny saffron, come into the village, they would say things like, "This is the first time ever in living memory someone in saffron has come to our village. You have to stay." And practically every single person in the village would be standing there with grains and rotis and sabji and sweets and coconuts and, you know, juice. Everybody would want to feed the devotees. What a wonderful thing. What a wonderful culture. But specially occasioned by the arrival of sannyasis and brahmacharis in their village. So this is the culture. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was very interested in capturing persons who only really had interest in the status of sannyasis. This was the only way that they would bow down. You see. Now, Prabhupada is talking here something else. He's talking about the different types of brahmacharya and the different types of sannyas. Why is this important for us? Well, it is because it helps us to understand the traditional, by understanding the traditional nomenclature, the names for the different grades of brahmacharya, we can understand where we fit in. I have a problem. I get lost. I never used to get lost. I used to have, you know, I'm still a good map reader. And of course, the day I came to the temple was the first day I had to read a map, practically speaking. All right, a couple of days. I spent a couple of days at the temple cleaning out things and transporting rubbish. And then they said, well, something we do here is called Sankirtan. And we go all over the country selling Srila Prabhupada's books. Would you like to go? I said, oh, yes. I was thinking, anything but the rubbish. Anything but cleaning. But travel sounded good to me. Travel sounded good to me. So for 6 years, I was traveling. And that meant literally, quite literally sometimes, sleeping under trees and sleeping in various other places, school halls, church halls, people's living rooms, wherever we could. But use of a map was absolutely important because you had to get from one good town to another good town. And especially when the good town turned out not to be a good town and the police there seemed to not, somehow, for some reason, not to want the presence of the Vaishnavas. You'd have to find your way from a bad town to a good town. So reading a map was very important, because if you couldn't read a map, that was Sankirtan time, lost, and that was not very good. But these days, sometimes, I do get a little bit confused, and I can't read the map so well, especially when it's dark. So I need these. Unfortunately, as Shakespeare said, as you get older, you lose your eyes, you lose your nose, you lose your taste, and eventually you lose everything. So the eyes go, and the map is difficult to read in the dark, and where's my glasses? I can't. So I recently bought a sat-nav, or I had one bought for me for my birthday, and I can tell you. I must tell you, though, I got lost once in India, and this was in Alape, and I got so badly lost. I got so badly lost that I didn't even remember the name of the hotel that we were supposed to be in. And I just said, I was saying to the taxi driver, I said, what's the name of the hotel by the river? And of course, this particular place, Alape, is like Amsterdam. It's crisscrossed by canals. So I said, and I had to make a sort of sound with my mouth that sounded vaguely like the hotel. Of course, in South India, it sounded something like this. And they would just look at me and they think, what's this guy on? So eventually I was found. But I bought a sat-nav. I had one bought for me. And it is a great relief. A great relief. I know where I am at every moment. And the most important thing about satellite navigation is not only listening to the voice, turn right. And if you don't turn right, it's turn around. Then 200 yards down the road, turn around when possible. They never get angry with you. But the most important part is always knowing where you are. That's why when you go on the London Underground and you see the map of the Underground on the wall, the dirtiest part will be where that station is. It'll be, in fact, it'll be rubbed away because thousands and thousands of travelers have pointed at that part. And you do that often enough, it gets rubbed away, saying, oh, we're here. Knowing where you are in life is most important. The next most important thing is knowing where you're supposed to be going. Okay? Knowing the ultimate destination, that's very important. But knowing the next stage in your life is very important. Otherwise, it gets very confusing. So these ashrams are stage-based or life stage-based ashrams. They're meant for people at different points in their life. And you're meant to know, I'm here, and this is where I'm going. This is the next stage. And what the guru does, the guru is like the sat-nav. He tells you, stay on this road. Or, now you're coming to a fork in the road. Bear left. Okay? Or, now your destination is 3 miles away. So what the guru does, he's the reassuring voice that tells you, you're at this stage, you're trying to get to this stage, and the ultimate destination is there. That, you've got that down. But it's a long way between where you are and your ultimate destination. And you can't reach that ultimate destination unless you know the different directions to get to. So that's the guru's business. You're here, and we're trying to get you here. Now, what do you need in order to get here? Well, in order to get from here to here, you need to bear left. But once we reach that stage, on that next stage, to get to the next stage after, you need to bear right. Okay? So therefore, sometimes these different aspects within the different ashrams, okay, so now we don't have 4 ashrams, we have 8 ashrams, pretty much. 16, isn't it? Four divisions of 4 is 16. So we have 16 ashram divisions. So let's hear, what are they? So Prabhupada talks about, it's very interesting actually, and you can see where you are. I'm going to do the brahmachari, then I'm going to do the vanaprastha, and I'm going to talk about sannyas. These are the 4 divisions. So, first brahmachari level is savitriya, one who's received the Gayatri Mantra. The Gayatri Mantra is dedicated to Savitur. So one who's received the Savitur Mantra becomes a savitriya. So this person is known as the Dikshita. He's just received initiation, which means he's just begun. Initiation means the beginning. You know, one lady once said to me, oh, I'm initiated now. I finally made it. No, I said, you've finally begun. Iniziazione means the beginning. I'm just begun. So getting the Gayatri Mantra is the beginning. Upanayanam, you come closer to the eyes. You come closer to the guru's eyes, can see the world as it is. Upanayanam means you come closer to those eyes, you come closer. Prajapatya. Prajapatya is the next stage of brahmachari ashram. And remember, you can be a Brahmin brahmachari. Oh, this is where it gets really complicated now, because we have 4 varnas as well. So you can be a Brahmin brahmachari, savitriya. Or you can be a kshatriya brahmachari, savitriya. Okay? We need a chart. We need a chart. You need a map. An app. An ashram app. Has anybody seen the Japa app? Have you seen the Japa app? Okay, it's got beads on it. You can touch the beads and you can chant on your phone. You haven't seen it? It's great. It's got 108 Japa beads on it. It's fun. It's no substitute for beads. So a kshatriya, sometimes he can be a brahmachari for how long? He can take a vow to remain a brahmachari for 1 month. Pretty tough vow. Sometimes a kshatriya can vow to be a brahmachari for 3 days. Because they're passionate. They can't stay celibate for very long. Okay? Kshatriyas, they're firing on all cylinders. You know, 16, they're married. 17, they're head of an army. 18, they've died on the battlefield. That's a kshatriya. Okay? Abhimanyu didn't even make it to 18. Only 16. But he was already married with children. Kshatriyas, they're unbelievable. Pure kshatriyas. So how long is their brahmachari vow? They have to become brahmacharis because that is the Vedic culture. But they become brahmacharis for 3 days. And if they're really good, 1 month. Or 6 months. And if they're really, really good, prajapatya. Prajapatya. 1 year. Brahmachari for 1 whole year. So prajapatya means one who gives everything away for 1 year. And just imagine the brahmacharis that we have in ISKCON. Incredible. They're flying so high. Next is Brahma. Brahma means one who has accepted the Vedas. Achar is got a very interesting etymology. Achar means one that flows like water. One that flows like water. Water follows its own course. The river follows the course of the river. That's called chara. When you walk and you follow the course, that's chara. So achara means the walking which follows the course of walking. Just like we say vartma pradarshika. Vartma is a path across a field that's been made by lots of people walking over it for many, many years. Sometimes we find a footpath, and many, many people have walked over that for hundreds of years. That's known as a vartma. So a vartma is, you know, it's a well-trodden path. So Brahma means Brahman, means the spirit. In our case, it means Parabrahman. So Brahman, Achar, one who walks the path of the spirit. How does he do that? By studying the Vedas. And then when he's Pravin, where's Pravin? There he is, Pravin. Told him this yesterday. Pravin means a brahmachari who has matured. A brahmachari who has advanced is a Pravin. I put that in just for you, Pravin. He's also known as Brihat, or great. It means one who's mature, one who's developed. He's no longer a seedling, but the plant has developed and the plant is flowering. So we find that Lord Brahma himself created these. Of course, sometimes we say Chaturvarnyam Maya Srishtam, that Krishna himself created these ashrams, these Varna and ashrams. But in the Srimad Bhagavatam, we find that Krishna got Lord Brahma to do it. So in the Srimad Bhagavatam, 3rd canto, 12th chapter, 42nd verse, we find Savitram Prajapatyam Cha Brahmam Chata Brihat Tata. Then the thread ceremony for the twice born. We're talking about creation. So at the very beginning of creation, brahmachari life is created at the very beginning of creation. It's not something that has come as part of a tradition like the Benedictines or the Cistercians or this. Even those people we call monks, celibate monks, and they are following on this line because no matter where you are, you will rediscover brahmachari life because that is part of the Creator's intention for this world. You will rediscover it. As yoga means that you will always rediscover which is that which is at the deepest level. So you'll rediscover Krishna consciousness even if it's taken away from you. Okay? That's another point. Then the thread ceremony for the twice born was inaugurated, as were the rules to be followed for at least 1 year after acceptance of the Vedas. Rules for observing complete abstinence from sex life. And then it goes on, Varta Sanchaya Shalina Shiloncha Iti Vai Grihe. vocations in terms of Vedic injunctions, various professional duties in household life, and the method of maintaining a livelihood without anyone's cooperation by picking up rejected grains. Now, it's tough for Brahmins. If you want to live as a Brahmin, boy, is it tough. There's six divisions of things that you can do as a Brahmin, legitimately. Otherwise, if you don't do those six things, you will lose your status as a Brahmin. You won't be a Brahmin anymore. You'll be something else. So to be a Brahmin, it means you have to learn the Vedas, always, every day. Every single day, you have to read the books. Now, Prabhupada told us that. But you lose your status as a Brahmin if you do not read the Vedas on a daily basis. Other things, teaching the Vedas, giving in charity, accepting charity, performing samskaras and pujas for others. Okay, these six things. But reading the Vedas, you don't get any money. No one's going to pay you for reading a book. For teaching, you may get some dakshina. But do you know how much dakshina a Brahmin gets for teaching brahmacharis? Here's the rule. There's three different divisions of Brahmin teacher. First is the acharya. Acharya means someone who teaches with no expectation of reward. He teaches everything expecting nothing. Next is the upadhyaya. And the upadhyaya will teach a portion of the Vedas, but there's a deal up front. The acharya, there's no deal at all. He will teach you because, out of love and affection, he wants to teach you as his student, but there's no question of discussing dakshina. Why? Because otherwise it's a business transaction. Dakshina comes at the end of the period of education, which may be 12 years. In that time, the guru doesn't ask for anything. Except what? Firewood. Samitpani. Samitpani. Shrotriyam. Brahmanishtam. This is how you interact with the guru. You bring firewood. Why? Because he's reading the Vedas and doing fire yagas every day. Samitpani. With wood in your hands. This is brahmachari life. And what else may he do? He may fetch water. He may clean. Prabhupada told Sachinandan Swami, he said, brahmachari means carrying the guru's pot, getting water, cooking, cleaning, and massage. So this is what the brahmachari does for the elderly guru. Now, there's no mention of money, but at the conclusion, Sandipani Muni was an acharya. At the conclusion of Krishna's education, which Krishna was a brahmachari for how long? 64 days. Why? Because he wasn't a Brahmin. 64 days. And he was a quick learner. So he learned. And then he said, Gurudev, now I want to give you dakshina. And Sandipani Muni said, all right. And then he gave him a lot to do. He said, I want you to recover my dead son. Well, that's tough. That's tough. You see? But the guru may give you some big dakshina that he requires. But the idea is that he only asks at the end. When does the term of brahmachari education come? Not when the brahmachari is satisfied. Gurudev, I think I've learned enough of the Vedas now. I'm going home. No. It's when the guru understands that the brahmachari has learned everything. And he says, all right, now you can go home. Now you've learned everything. Or now you can go and teach. So, but the upadhyaya, he says, actually, I'm going to teach you the Vedas, but it's going to cost you. And this is how much it's going to cost you. This is what I want. So the deal is up front. This is the upadhyaya. So because the upadhyaya is more, this is how it happened in India, because the upadhyaya is more common. because the Brahmin who wants to know what he's going to get by teaching is more common. Therefore, the Acharyas became very rare species, and the Upadhyayas became... So in India now, if you say Upadhyaya, it's a term of great prestige and great respect. Oh, he's an Upadhyaya. But originally, it's a term which meant, no, he's not. And of course, these terms for Upadhyaya, they went all over India. And you could be a Upadhyaya who knew four Vedas, in which case you would be a Chatur Upadhyaya. Chatur Upadhyaya means, you know, the four Vedas. But the way language works in India, especially Gujaratis, like to soften Sanskrit. So a Sanskrit term like Mandapa Ropanam, in, after generations of Gujaratis speaking Mandapa Ropanam, it comes Mando. Mando. So the Chatur Upadhyaya went up to Bengal. Bengalis did the same thing. And it becomes Chatur. Chatur. And because a term of endearment is Ji, they become Chaturji. And Mukha Upadhyaya became Mukurji. And Bando Upadhyaya became Banerjee. So now Banerjee, Chaturji, Mukurji, these are Brahmin names, but the original meaning has been lost. Chatur Upadhyaya means one who can teach the four Vedas, a very learned man. He wants something. He doesn't trust that you'll fulfill his dakshin requirements. So then, how long have we got? Are we meant to finish at 9? Is that the idea? I've been cheated. How long should we go on for? We didn't get to the sannyas part. All right, let me just read this verse to you. This is the visions of retired life. Vakanasa valakilyo dumbara penapa vane. Okay? The four divisions of retired life are the Vaikanasas, Valakilias, Odumburas, and Penapas. And then we have a description. Luckily for us, we have a description in the 11th canto. Krishna himself tells us what Vanaprastha life is. This is a revelation for us in ISKCON. You're about to find out how Krishna wanted us to do it. Here it is. Are we ready, all these men over 50? Including Kripa Moya. Right. Okay. There's a description here of how brahmacharis should dress. Let's see. Say no if you're not doing this. The brahmachari should regularly dress with a belt of straw, deerskin garments. He should wear matted hair. Definitely not. Carry a rod and water pot and be decorated with beads and a sacred thread. Well, we got that part right. Carrying pure kusha grass in his hand, he should never accept a luxurious or sensuous sitting place. I see luxurious sitting places under this brahmachari, like a cushion. He should not unnecessarily polish his teeth. Sutapa, you've got a real problem. Nor should he bleach or iron his clothes. Well, we got no trouble with bleach. A brahmachari should always remain silent while bathing. I've never heard a silent brahmachari in the cold shower. While eating, he should not talk. He should not talk while attending sacrificial performances. When chanting japa, he should not talk. Do we follow that rule here in this temple? Okay. He should not cut his nails or hair. Okay. Anyway, it goes on. That's my phone, unfortunately. You can go into my bag, someone. It's in the green bag, and you'll see it just... slide it upwards. Okay. And at the end of this description of brahmachari life, Krishna says a verse which is very important. for how brahmacharis should live. Acharyang mam vijaniyan. Navamanyeta karichit namartya buddha suyeta sarvadeva mayo guru. One should know the acharya as myself and never disrespect him in any way. One should not envy him, thinking him an ordinary man, for he's the representative of all the demigods. That's at the conclusion of the brahmacharya's life description in the 11th canto. So then, here's a little bit more. While engaged in serving the spiritual master, one should remain as a humble servant. And thus when the guru is walking, the servant should humbly walk behind. When the guru lies down to sleep, the servant should also lie down nearby. And when the guru has awakened, the servant should sit near him, massaging his lotus feet and rendering other similar services. When the guru is sitting down on his asana, the servant should stand nearby with folded hands, awaiting the guru's order. In this way, one should always worship the spiritual master. Until the student has completed his Vedic education, he should remain engaged in the ashram of the spiritual master, should remain completely free of material sense gratification, and should not break his vow of celibacy. So then it goes on. It goes on. Grihastas. Okay. It's wonderful descriptions, actually. A Brahmana householder, I'll read this quickly, should remain satisfied in mind by gleaning rejected grains from agricultural fields and marketplaces. Keeping himself free of personal desire, he should practice magnanimous religious principles with consciousness absorbed in me. In this way, a Brahmin may stay at home as a householder without very much attachment and thus achieve liberation. So the rules for a householder, this is called the Shilonchana. This is the topmost type of householder who will just pick up grains in the field. My gosh, who could live like that? You could live like that if there were fields in which there were grains, in which the combine harvester hadn't taken them all, and if there was more than one crop a year, and you didn't have to pay huge central heating bills. Basically, we're living in a part of the world in which it's very difficult to follow the Vedas. So let's all leave. Well, we can't. We have a higher duty to do. So then he says, this is very interesting. If I can't do that, what can I do? Okay. If a Brahmin cannot support himself through his regular duties and is suffering, these are the words of Krishna, he may adopt the occupation of a merchant and overcome his destitute condition by buying and selling material things. If he continues to suffer extreme poverty even as a merchant, then he may adopt the occupation of a kshatriya, taking a sword in his hand. Now, this is interesting that a Brahmin first has to act as a merchant if they're suffering, and only if he really can't make it buying and selling things, then he can be a kshatriya. Not the other way around. No, I couldn't make it as a Brahmin, therefore I will do a kshatriya job. No, sell something. But he cannot in any circumstances become like a dog, accepting an ordinary master. Okay, then we go on about the householder's duties. It's a very interesting section, actually. So then, and I'm going to finish now. I'm going to finish because there's a very nice description of the Vanaprastha. Lord Krishna says, Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, one who desires to adopt the third order of life, Vanaprastha, should enter the forest with a peaceful mind, leaving his wife with his mature sons, or taking her along with him. Now, those were in the days when there were forests, and the forests weren't just full of pine needles, because you can't eat pine needles. The forests, we're talking forests like in America. Like in America, you go to Yellowstone Park or you go to Yosemite National Park and you'll find a park that's, 100 miles long by 80 miles wide. It's the size of Connecticut and it's wild. And you can go there and at least you can eat berries or you can eat something. See? But forest in this country, Sherwood Forest, Nottingham Forest, okay, what forests do we have? The forests that we have are in the north, and they're all full of pine trees, and they're made for IKEA furniture. This is not the sort of forest that they're talking about. Sort of forest that they're talking about is a forest where it's warm, a forest where you can find a tree big enough to shelter under, and there will be fruits and nuts and berries and roots. And it's a good idea before you become a vanaprastha to find out what you can eat and what you can't eat. Otherwise, your vanaprastha life will not be very long. So you have to have some knowledge. Having adopted the vanaprastha order of life, one should arrange one's sustenance by eating uncontaminated bulbs. It doesn't mean light bulbs. Okay. Bulbs are tubers. Doesn't mean a musical instrument. A tubor is something that grows under the ground. It's a big root. One root is mogo. Everybody likes mogo, cassava. But if you eat cassava straight from the ground, you'll be poisoned. You have to extract the poison. There's a process for extracting the poison of the cassava plant. Then it's very nice. Roots or fruits that grow in the forest. One may dress oneself with tree bark, grass, leaves, or animal skins. Very good. The vanaprastha should not groom the hair on his head, body, or face, should not manicure his nails, should not pass stool and urine at irregular times, and should not make a special endeavor for dental hygiene. You know, the Vedas are pretty tough on teeth, aren't they? We got the brahmacharis with a mouthful of rotten teeth. You got the vanaprasthas with a mouthful of rotten teeth. But it just means that you don't make any extraneous endeavor, extra endeavors. You see. He should be content to take bath in water 3 times daily and should sleep on the ground. Smara, you ready for this? Okay, you do it and I'll do it, okay? We'll take a vanaprastha vow. Thus engaged as a vanaprastha. Well, in our case, it's just vanaprastha. jumping in the van. You have a van. Somebody lives in a van. One should execute penance during the hottest summer days by subjecting oneself to burning fires on 4 sides and the blazing sun overhead. During the rainy season, one should remain outside, subjecting oneself to torrents of rain. And in the freezing winter, one should remain submerged in water up to one's neck. This is a tough life, this Krishna consciousness, if you want to do it properly. Who said the way that we're living now is tough? This is the real thing. We once had a devotee. His name was Dhiranaika. You know him, Smara. Dhiranaika. And he had heard that in the morning you have to chant Gayatri, semi-submerged in water. Okay? You know how you stand in the Ganga, in the river. So he'd heard that Prabhupada had said that. So enough that Prabhupada had said it, he wanted to do it. The only trouble was that when I saw him do it, it was December. And it was a village pond. But he said, Prabhupada said it, and we're going to do this. Well, I wasn't a Brahmin at that time, so I didn't have to do it. But Dhiranaika did it. And when he came out of that water, his top half was kind of hot pink, and his bottom half was purple. He didn't do it very often after that. But anyway, it goes on. It goes on. And you still have to perform fire sacrifices. Okay, now it gets interesting. Here's what happens to a man who takes sannyas. And this may be something that our sannyasis in ISKCON could read. Having worshipped me, Lord Krishna says, according to scriptural injunctions and having given all one's property to the sacrificial priest, one should place the fire sacrifice within oneself. Thus, with the mind completely detached, one should enter the sannyas order of life. Here's what happens. This man taking sannyas is going to surpass us and go back home, back to Godhead. Thus thinking, the demigods create stumbling blocks on the path of the sannyasi by appearing before him in the shape of his former wife. or other women and attractive objects. But the sannyasi should pay the demigods and their manifestations no heed. This is very interesting. This is why it's very difficult to be a sannyasi. Because a sannyasi has made a firm commitment. He said sannyas. Sannyas means frozen desires. Complete rejection. Nothing more. Now, it's all very well to have aspirations, but when you make a firm commitment, a dridha vrata, then that dridha vrata goes up from the fire sacrifice of the sannyasi, and it goes up to the demigods, and they're hearing, oh, some man has made this big commitment. Let's now go. And it's at that moment that we hear the heavenly saxophone playing. It's a joke. And there she comes. There she comes. His former wife or some other attractive object. What happens? Huh? I don't know. But it goes on here. He says, if the sannyasi desires to wear something besides a mere kopin, he may use another cloth around his waist and hips to cover the kopin. Otherwise, if there's no emergency, he should not accept anything besides his danda and water pot. A saintly person should step or place his foot on the ground only after verifying with his eyes that there are no living creatures such as insects who might be injured by his foot. He should drink water only after filtering it through a portion of his cloth and should speak words that possess the purity of truth. Similarly, he should perform only those activities his mind has carefully ascertained to be pure. Now, this person, the Fenapa, I think the Fenapa is a person who lives on the fruits which automatically fall from the tree. That's one division of Vanaprastha. And the Audumbara, this is very interesting, the Audumbara is a person who only, when he gets out of bed in the morning, he walks in that direction, and he only begs in that direction. And elsewhere in the 11th canto, we find that the Vanaprastha or the sannyasi will only beg, firstly, in one direction, secondly, from 11 houses in that direction, secondly, from 5 houses in that direction, secondly, from 3 houses in that direction. In other words, whatever you get that day, that's what you eat. So you're dependent. It makes you very, very dependent psychologically on the mercy of the Lord. You may get a lot one day, you may not. So these are very, I mean, we cannot change this. This was created by Lord Brahma. We can only look and think that, gosh, if only I was capable to live in that way. But when we talk of sannyas, and we talk of taking sannyas, we should know what we're talking about. This is sannyas created by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, sannyas was created yet again, Tridandi sannyas was created yet again by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati in extended conversation at Sri Parambadur with the Sri Vaishnavas, who taught him many things about sannyas. He took sannyas and he had 18 sannyasi disciples. All of them were Brahmins. All of them came from Brahmin households. And sometimes, why, in the Gaudiya Math, you have a person who's a brahmachari, but he never took sannyas. Because the rule is, in the Gaudiya Math, you have to come from a Brahmin home in order to take sannyas. He was very, you know, not only do we have to have sannyasis that can preach, but in India, we have to have sannyasis who at least have got the status of Brahmins. We can't shake up the Varnashram system too much. Of course, he did say that those by chanting Hare Krishna, they become more than Brahmins, Vaishnavas, and therefore we will give them the sacred thread. So this was one move that he didn't make. But again, he would not let his sannyasi disciples go to the dentist. A lot of times they had no shoes. When they were sick, they couldn't always get medicines. And he would say, don't think that because you're a sannyasi, you can use the temple car. Better that you walk to such and such a place. Okay. So he's very, very austere. And then Prabhupada came and created so many sannyasis for preaching in the West. But we should know sannyas according to Shastra, and then you'll be able to measure up sannyasis and brahmacharis and vanaprastas. It's very, very austere. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he took sannyas, that's why everybody wept. Everybody wept when his hair was shaven from his head. Firstly, because he had lovely hair, beautiful hair that came. You can see how his hair was up until he was 24. Secondly, he was only 24. Pancharudvam vanam rajat. When one is 50, one must take sannyas, Shastra says. He was only half that age, less than half that age. And so he shaves his head, and then the barber who shaves his head, he never shaved another head after that. And they took the hair of the Lord, and they put it into samadhi. They buried it in the ground and erected a shrine above it. And you can go today to Katwa, and there you will find Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's hair in a box buried in the ground. You can go and pay your respects. But people were around, they were saying, please don't do this. Don't do it. You don't have to live like this. Because they knew what sannyas meant. They knew what sannyas meant. And now forevermore. And it wasn't a question that, oh, he was a sannyasi, but I don't think he's a sannyasi anymore. I think he went back to his... No, 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 no. You cannot do that. You cannot do that. So when you take sannyas, that is it. That is it. So when he was 24 and they said, don't take sannyas because we're older than you. We know what this involves. We know. Look, you're an attractive young man. You have a young wife. You cannot take sannyas. Please don't do this. Please think again about this. Is there some problem at home? Is there some religious urge that may come for a small amount of time and then go? Please, don't do it. And they were weeping. In the Gopinath Bazaar, you find that beautiful painting of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taking sannyas at Katwa. And everybody is gathered around. And you see everybody's, it's a beautiful painting. Everybody's crying. Everybody's crying. Please don't do this. You see, that's the end of normal life. Prabhupada used to say, civilly dead. Civilly dead, dead to the world. No more interaction. No more normal interaction. You're lost to your village. You're lost to the country. You see? So it's something which has to be extremely, extremely... Otherwise, it is said that if one cannot revive this Varnashram system, then people cannot move forward in God consciousness. You know? I used to think, back on my third day out on Sankirtan, that what I was teaching and preaching was that the entire world would become basically shaven-headed and wear robes. And that when Lord Chaitanya's mission went all over the world, this is what everybody would look like, this is what everybody would do. It's not like that. We find that this is very rare, and we find that most people, they look quite normal, but they may practice Krishna consciousness. We have to be very, very grateful for whatever we get, and it is not that we may find many, many people coming forward for, at least we've got to make it easy for them in a cold country. Immediately you leave the ashram here, and you have to find independent means of support. It's extremely difficult. Extremely difficult. It's very relatively easy to be Krishna conscious in a wonderful temple like Bhaktivedanta Manor. You can go to some parts of ISKCON, and it's very, very difficult to be a brahmachari. I've been in places where I was the only brahmachari. For 2 years, I was the only brahmachari. You know how difficult that is? To be the only person in Saffron. I spent 2 years like that, the only person in Saffron. And then I tried to put someone in Saffron, and he lasted about, 5 days. And I found the other one worshipping voodoo dolls in his, you know, cupboard with a goat, sharpened goat's tooth. And, you know, it'd be very, very, very difficult. So what we have done, what you have done, what you brahmacharis have done is like... it's amazing. But beware. Beware. The demigods are getting a little bit upset. Okay, the demigods are getting a little upset, and they're saying, let's remind these young men, okay, and these young ladies. Prabhupada did create a Brahmacharini ashram. Let's remember that. Brahmacharini ashram in ISKCON is a little bit like pandas. It needs protection because it's a dying species. A woman who comes to Krishna consciousness and wants to live a simple, humble life in the ashram is very much a dying species all over ISKCON. We have to be very careful, because if that goes, then it won't be very good for the future of our movement. I just thought I'd put that in, just as a little plug. But some parts of ISKCON are very, very, they're struggling. Yeah. Some temples in ISKCON, the last time they saw a brahmachari was like 10 years ago. Yeah. You go to Villa Vrindavan, brahmachari is like, wow, wonderful. You know, if we ever have a brahmachari come to the temple. And then these guys turn up, 35 brahmacharis turn up all at once, and they think the whole spiritual world has descended to Florence. So it's a wonderful thing. It's a great richness. But let us remember, we usually like Krishna to be the all-accommodating, all-merciful Krishna. This sentimentalization of Krishna is part of the sentimentalization of modern society. And you will find that Krishna, apart from being the person who plays the flute and who looks lovely on the altar, dressed in flowers and silks, you will also find that Krishna is the person who writes the book of rules for the varnas and the ashramas. That being the case, Krishna is also the lawmaker, and he's also very firm. So please, I beg you, do not sentimentalize Krishna. Don't turn him into a cartoon. You know, don't turn him into baby Krishna that never gets upset, whatever you do. That is not our object of worship. We are worshippers of the Bhagavatam. And in Srimad Bhagavatam, we'll find Krishna says many things. So it's not that we should reject the 11th canto and settle for something else. Krishna is speaking to Uddhava, and he's explaining the things that he didn't explain to Arjuna. Didn't have time to explain all these things to Arjuna. It wasn't relevant. But when Krishna had a chance, then he spoke again. And the Uddhava Gita is 1,200 verses compared to the Bhagavad Gita's 700 verses. So we see Krishna has a lot more to say. And we should not reject it and think that, oh, whatever I do, whatever I say, Krishna will be pleased with me because he loves me. This is a sentimentalist's view of Krishna consciousness. We cannot do it. And so therefore, we should be merciful with others, but very, very strict with ourselves. Hare Krishna. 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, ki. Brahmacharya ashram, ki. Grihastha ashram, ki. Vanaprastha ashram, ki. Sannyas ashram, ki. Okay, and just remember, each of them has their own rules. Don't try and copy. Brahmacharis should not copy sannyasis. Grihasthas should not copy brahmacharis. This mixing of the ashrams that goes on in ISKCON messes it up for everybody. Don't, if you're a grihastha, be a grihastha. If you're a brahmachari, be a brahmachari. If you're a sannyasi, please, I beg you, be a sannyasi. I need the inspiration. And if you're a vanaprastha, try it out. Be it. Okay? Hare Krishna.